this latest installment of mini-series Forces of Nature, we welcome Jennifer Hashley of the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project out of Tufts University. Tune into Sourcing Matters to hear what the future of local food from regional production looks like.
Hi, Aaron. How are you? I like our kitchen setup.
Right? Welcome to my kitchen. There you go. Good setup. Like, everything is absolutely perfect in the kitchen, except for right here, right there. See it? One mug missing. I was reaching up there to grab it. It dropped. Sometimes that happens, right? It's stoneware is tough to replace, especially a set like this. So, you know, it's challenging. Yeah,
you're missing a red one too.
Oh my gosh. What happened? Someone came in here. Oh, well. So, how's it going? Everything well?
Yep. Everything's going well. It's a beautiful, beautiful day.
Yeah, it is. Perfect fall day.
Unseasonably so, right? Like, we can just kick it off with, like, why on earth are we having 70 degree weather in November? I don't know.
I know. But, you know, it's always like that little kind of challenging part of that conversation, because, you know, always that's brewing in the back of your mind, but try to keep that positive. Like, just, all right, I'll take the happy day. I'll take it, even though it is a bit concerning. We're in November here, and yeah, 70 plus degrees, New England. Hey, soon enough, we'll be like Virginia, and you could grow almost year round. It might work out well for you. So
I'm looking forward to having figs and citrus and bananas growing, you know, outside of Boston. So right. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, you just have to deal with the seawater that comes up. See, there's that negative little voice in the back of my head that always comes in. Sheriff's in there.
Well, it's true. I just heard a story yesterday about a parcel of land that, you know, we were hoping might be available for one of our beginning farmers, but the town might want to buy it, you know, again, to basically mitigate against sea level rise, because they're trying to get access to their transfer station, and their current road might be flooded in a few years. So they're like, oh, we need to buy this piece of farmland so that we can have an access road.
Oh, interesting.
It's higher and drier than our other land. So
whether
that'll be another source of competition for future farmers is, you know, all these other land uses, because we're going to have less of a land base. Who knows?
I know, right? And there you go. Food production always being the can kicked down the road, right? I guess that's always the problem. So, hey, let's go positive here. We're gonna talk about some good things. We're going to talk about local food production, regionalized food production. And ultimately, you know, I look to you as being the expert. Every time I want to chat with someone about what is happening in local food production, what the potential is, what the capacity is, you are the first person to come to mind. So maybe we can talk to the audience about some of the positive elements that are happening in local and regionalized food systems, starting the Northeast, but just more generally what you've seen across the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the trend has been growing for the last 10 or 15 years. You know, I think 2007 was the peak when, you know, Merriam-Webster's dictionary, like, locavore became the word of the year. I think, you know, the trend of farmers markets increasing across the country, people joining community supported agriculture programs and really understanding that risk sharing model with farmers, you know, farm stands coming up and running, people caring more about food and where it came from after we had all these food scares, you know, celebrity chefs and that whole trend. I mean, all of that, I think, has been driving people to care more about where their food comes from, and certainly with climate change and other things. And then I think I think it had been increasing, and then it seemed to local farmers like it was peaking a little bit with the whole, you know, convenience and meal kit delivery programs that were popping up. And then all of a sudden, you know, the traditional model of you'll come to us, you'll come to the farm, or you'll come to the market, or you'll get your CSA delivered to you at your workplace was, you know, a little bit like, oh, well, now what? I can get a whole meal with local ingredients delivered to my house, and all I have to do is assemble it and eat. And, you know, as chefs were, you know, really promoting local, I think it became easier and easier. And then we started eating out more. And then, of course, the pandemic happens. And that really changed everything. You know, people were stuck at home eating three meals a day and really, you know, seeing the supply chain for its fragileness and, you know, seeing, yeah, just the global impacts of that. And now I think that's been another boost to local and regional agriculture, because those were the places in a lot of part of the country, and especially in New England and the Northeast, that, you know, local farmers could step up and were busy growing food. And, you know, they were impacted to some degree, but not as much as, you know, big ag. We just had Dr. Temple Grandin, who's, you know, the renowned animal handling, slaughterhouse, humane handling expert. And I liked it. She had a really great phrase that was, you know, what was it, something like big supply chains are fragile, but it was more like big industrial ag is very efficient but also very fragile. Like right. Any little tweak to those systems we see the effects of. And like she was also promoting, for sustainability and the long haul, we need a lot more local and regional production, and we need both. She's like, we need a mix of both. And that's kind of always been my philosophy, is like the big guys are good at what they do, but we also still need to complement that with a lot of local and regional, and which is less efficient, but certainly more secure and stable and sustainable in the long run. Cause we all fill in those interstitial gaps of, where the big guys are weak. And when those big guys have interruptions, we're there to, keep things moving along smoothly.
Yeah. We absolutely saw that during COVID, right? And especially in some of the bottlenecks, meat production being an example, and processing, it's still having a ripple effect. And I think we're trying to throw some resources at it. I don't know if they're going to the appropriate parties to actually solve these problems, which is to really, the only future of food systems, which ultimately what I've learned from speaking to so many experts for these few years here, the only future is regionalized food systems, just purely for redundancy and capacity to basically deal with the disruptions.
Yeah. We need that infrastructure to support it. I think, we need to throw more money at it, because when the big guys have, it's so concentrated, they've really forced a lot of those, those processing and regionalized infrastructure components, cold storage, whatever, processing, delivery mechanisms, all that stuff has disappeared. And so how do we rebuild that? We have to invest in it. And that's good for jobs. It's good for the economy. It's good for, security. It's good for all those things.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a bit of a mind shift for consumers, right? Because, local and regionalized food, when you're doing it at a smaller scale, is going to be more expensive when it hits market, right? And how do we get to a point where the question becomes not that this quality, high nutrient dense food, better for the planet, better for you, better for the farmer, is better, but the fact that cheap food is real cheap and has these externalities and has big problems. So where are we? Are you seeing progress, or where do we stand on that crossing the chasm?
Yeah, I think we're not still quite there. I think that, the elite consumers who have resources, they can afford to do that. Mm. And then there's the other part of the spectrum where there's being more resources, in the dialogue and in public, public funding and things to support the folks who are really on the polar end of the spectrum, who can't even afford the cheap food. Like they just really are fully insecure for a whole lot of other systemic reasons, all that we can go into. But, I think there's more recognition that we need to bolster that consumer demand of folks that can't access healthy food to begin with, that are also causing a huge drain on our healthcare system and other systemic issues. And then, there's the elite, but then how do we get the folks in the middle who don't even think about it, like who just blindly go to box stores and shop and don't really care where it comes from or have any value, consideration and what they're purchasing? How do we change their hearts and minds, I think, to really care more and pay more? And how do we make local and regional food more convenient for people? Is that, really encouraging the larger chain stores to have more of a local food purchasing program, to have all of our schools and institutions have more funding to buy local food? Those are ways that we can continue to build up the local and regional food economy. If institutional procurement is a huge, huge dollars that are both publicly funded and otherwise. And if they can even shift 10-20% of their buying power to local, that will grow the supply by a long shot. And then maybe it becomes more affordable for other regional vendors and things to buy local. And then it just becomes everywhere. Then it becomes easier. And then people think about it more because they understand it's promoted more. And then it just becomes part of people's habits. Yeah. But we're not quite there yet. I think we're getting closer, but.
Yeah. Is the big problem for institutional players like schools, prisons, states, colleges, whatever it may be, is the consistency of delivery? I mean, we're in New England, right? So we do have a relatively limited grow season. Even with hoop houses, indoor growing, controlled environment, we're still going to have limitations. So is that their problem? Is it just that it's always been the other way and it takes time? It's a glacial move to get these things to adapt.
Yeah, I think, I think there definitely is seasonality is a concern. And then I think, if if people can't be competitive because we're competing against food coming internationally and globally from all over the place, you know, where there are different cost structures, it's a challenge. And then, you know, people put in their systems in place when they order from one vendor who's, you know, just a push of a button, and it's easy to get a whole tractor trailer load of product from, you know, one or two vendors. Like, for them to revamp all of their systems and start onboarding lots and lots of smaller regional vendors, like, that's a huge extra cost as well. And then, you know, is the quality and consistency and quantities and varieties and things going to be what they need? You know, we deal with that in our own programming, you know, working with schools. Like, you know, they can order from a mainline distributor and get it already peeled, chopped, and processed. And it's like, well, we don't have those processing facilities. There aren't any really even close to us in the region that we could affordably take locally grown product to say, can you peel, chop, and flash freeze this, put it in a bag, and give it back to us at a price then we can afford to sell it to a school and they can afford to pay for it. Like,
right.
You know, everybody across the supply chain has to, you know, be in sync and be able to, you know, get to a scale. And like, I think that's where the big industry has done well, is they could get to these huge economies of scale and make that food affordable.
Yep.
But like you said, at what cost? Are they treating labor well? Are they really costing, you know, covering all of their costs of production? Are they exporting that to elsewhere, these environmental externalities? And then we're subsidizing the transportation system in many ways, like to make it even affordable to get it from one part of the world to another. So until we look at those things at face value and figure out how do we do that regionally, I don't know, we still have a ways to go.
Yeah. So. And those infuriating conversations almost at a, you know, political decision-making when, well, they allocate a couple bucks per school lunch, per meal per school lunch, and then you try to integrate something where it would be regionalized food or some kind of a produce integration or something around, you know, perishable, better quality food and nutrient-dense food. And the folks fighting it are the ones saying, well, they just throw these veggies in the trash. Why waste this, right? And so, oh my gosh, where do you begin in these conversations with that, right? Like, maybe it's a no-win. Maybe those dinosaurs will kind of age themselves.
Give them a little more time to eat the food, maybe, or don't eat, you know, lunch with recess. I don't know. I feel like,
or don't put Doritos against broccoli. Yeah. Well, hey, one of the other things on the regional side of things, or you know, kind of regionalized and local food system is labor. And you know, one of the areas that new entry sustainable farming project, just turned 20 years old. Right. I mean, you started that 24 years ago.
We're 24.
Never mind. 24 years old. 20. That's like when you get older in age, you start saying, well, I turned 45, 50 again and again and again. So yeah. 24. Wow. Congratulations. Incredible. And, you know, so as this localized food system gains more awareness, general public is there. Are you seeing an uptick in folks interested in new entry? Are you seeing an engagement in that we need producers to actually grow this food? Where do things stand there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and it's an interesting question because, you know, the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project, we're a farmer training program. So we're helping folks that want to be entrepreneurs and own their own farming business do that process from, you know, write a business plan, get on the incubator farm, start your business, market your product, hopefully graduate from the incubator and continue to farm and be your own owner operator. Well, then they need labor also.
Right.
So, you know, people may go through that process and opt out and be like, oh, I don't want to own my own business. I'd rather work for someone, maybe be a farm manager or something. But that's pretty rare. Most people that we work with want to become farm owner operators, just, you know, at whatever size and scale they want. But the industry as a whole is definitely struggling for labor. You know, we compete, you know, again, these jobs are seasonal in New England, especially. And so, you know, what's the real career pathway if you're going to be a farm worker or farm manager or other farm employee in the sector? If you may only have a job 8 months of the year, what do you do the other 4 months of the year? And then, you know, it's outside in all kinds of weather conditions, a lot of hard physical work, repetitive work, but also really fulfilling work in many ways of providing food to the community. So, you know, there are definitely career pathways to be had. I think we don't promote them enough as a society. You know, you don't go to school saying, hey, there's an opportunity to become a farmer, food producer, or a manager of a farm. Like, people just don't even talk about the farm sector, really, other than what you see in the news. So, you know, a lot of the industry relies on guest worker visa programs or, you know, migratory labor contractors or illegal, you know, undocumented workers as well. And so that it gets vilified a lot as being, you know, unfair to those workers as well. And then, you know, we have our local and regional producers here who are paying fairly. I mean, farms are paying $15 to $20 an hour. They're paying $50, $60, $70,000 a year for farm management positions with benefits. So it's not like you can't find jobs that will pay well in this sector. It's like, are people trained? Do they have the skills?
Yeah.
Are they going to stay with it? And then when you lay them off because you don't grow food in the winter, although more farms are trying to, you know, do more season extension and grow more year round, or are doing processing, and so maybe there's more of a food business related to the farm than just growing, you know, raw product. You know, so I think people are thinking about that, but it's something that, you know, the industry struggles with year after year after year.
Yeah. One of the big hurdles also, and we're here in the Northeast, population density, of course, one of the big problems is land access. And so you've created an interesting relationship with the trustees of reservation where you're on Moraine Farm up in Beverly for new entry training these new producers. How has your experience been in land access, and you know, what do you see on the horizon for getting more land to be able to grow food?
Oh, that one's a real tricky one. Yeah, it's really tough, especially in these urban and suburban and peri-urban areas where land density is, you know, its best and highest use is for development or industry or whatever. I mean, people want flat tillable farmland to build on because that's the easiest part, you know, parcels to develop, which is challenging. And yeah, it's really hard. For a number of years in our organization, we had a farmland matching program where we had a full-time staff person dedicated to kind of being a private real estate agent for farms, both on the supply side, working with landowners, towns, communities, land trusts, trying to make land available for agriculture, production agriculture in, you know, particular, not just hay fields or whatever, but like, let's grow vegetables or other, you know, livestock crops, which is a different use. And then, you know, there we have to develop the supply so people know that there are people that want to farm. And then we have our farm seeker driven matching process of like trying to find individual farmers who come through our program. Like, what's the enterprise that they want to do? What communities do they want to be able to access? Where they close to where they live? Is there housing on the land? Is it a lease or is it an ownership opportunity? Is it affordable? Is it secure? Right. You know, does it have the infrastructure that it needs? Like, there's so much complexity across land access. And you know, we have some of the most expensive farmland in the nation. It's, you know, $12,000+ an acre or $1 million, you know, for a half acre or a, you know, development lot, like, you know, take your pick. Urban ag is, you know, similarly challenging because it's assumed contaminated with lead or other heavy metals or who knows what from whatever has happened in that community prior. So most urban ag programs, even if they could get a parcel of land, you know, usually have to build the farm from the ground up. So bringing in impermeable barriers, importing all the soil, growing up, you know, figuring out their water connections in a city, you know, dealing with multiple municipal agencies, like all of those drive up costs. You know, it can cost a minimum of $150,000 to get like a tiny little urban plot. And like, how do you grow enough tomatoes to depreciate that over time or pay off your mortgage over time? So land access is a huge challenge. USDA actually has a grant proposal due out right now called Investing in Land, Capital, and Markets for Farmers. And they're really looking to throw, you know, tens of millions of dollars at innovative national, regional, and localized projects to come up with some new solutions to how do we get access to the next generation of farmers, and particularly BIPOC and other people of color who have been historically, you know, discriminated and had their land stolen from them over the years. I mean, 98% of farm ownership in this country is white.
Right.
And then that is not accidental by any way, shape, or form. So, you know, we have to also think about who has access to land. And when we're pushing forward with land access opportunities, how do we, you know, help get more, you know, diverse farmers and people of color back into land ownership and wealth building opportunities?
Yeah. I mean, I would, with farmland, right? Everything is so leveraged, and then you have to go get more and more land, get bigger, get out. Butts made that even, you know, be expedited, right? For 50 years ago. And so there is that intrinsic and you know, the kind of racism built into access to that capital to even get the resources needed to buy the land to even produce the crops or the equipment. And
the infrastructure piece is huge. I mean, I think we struggle with that a lot too. Like I always like to say, you know, land is not a farm until all the pieces on the land make it work together as a farm. We have farmers that graduate from our program and can find raw land, but then they end up spending $100,000 putting in the deer fence and the irrigation and the greenhouse and the wash station and the cooler and, like, you know, all the infrastructure that they need to build to run their enterprise. So when we get calls from landowners like, hey, I have this field, it's like, okay, is there water access? And, you know, as we know now with all the climate variability, it's like, okay, if you don't have water, you're probably not going to grow crops. And if you have too much water, is there good drainage in the field? Like, will you just not be able to plant because you can't get into the field because it's sopping wet and floods? So we have to really think about, you know, not just land, but like, is the land resilient to Mother Nature? You know, how will it function and grow food in increasing drought tolerant condition or drought conditions or flood, you know, flood conditions?
I think it's, I mean, I guess they're good intentions, right? That people actually want to be part of the solution. They know that we need to regionalize and create more local food opportunities. There's, I think, a general awareness that there's been some problems with getting equal opportunity for people to get on land. It's like in a matter of a few years, we've awoken to these big issues. Like we've realized that things have to change. I, you know, one of those big issues obviously is climate and social welfare issues, and food systems has definitely become a bit of the darling to solve those problems. And I think within even a few years, you've seen it hitting mainstream and media. Like, everyone's now talking about regenerative food systems and the potential of sequestering carbon into the soil, or access that you're giving fair wages for labor. You've been speaking about it for 24 years plus. Finally, people are going to say overnight success, 30 years in the making. But, you know, now we're at a point where it's spoken at a very top level. We have conferences at the White House. We're having conferences at COP27. We're talking about food systems as this big solutions of change program. And never mind all of the individual UN programs on biodiversity, water, ocean, and then all of the other sub-conferences are there. Are we just doing a lot of talking about this? I mean, how much is actually getting done, or do we have to go through this process, the steps to continue to come to a consensus, and then we can start taking action?
I think a little bit of both. I think we have to talk about it. People have to get on board. There needs to be research. There needs to be consensus. I mean, I think more and more everyone globally is realizing that this isn't a developing country issue or a less developed country issue.
Right.
It's a global human issue, right? Mm-hmm. We all share the same planet. So, and we all as humans eat. Yep. So those two basic things, and we all need water. I mean, that's the next, you know, the other frontier of wars that will happen in the future when we run out of fresh water. Okay, so we're starting to realize we have to have a place to live. We have to inhabit our planet well. We have to eat and we have to drink.
Yeah.
And this is not something that we can do in isolation, country by country, political party by political party. It needs to be more of a unified approach, a systemic, systems-based approach. So bringing people together to the table to figure out strategies and share best practices and resources and things that are working and build on those assets and generate new ideas, I think, is important. But it can't just be all talk, to your point. I think, you know, we can have meetings and summits and summits, but until, you know, an agenda, a strategic plan, action steps and resources are allocated and then culture change follows, or culture change leads that process, whichever order that happens in, depending on the issue, all those things need to be put in place quickly. I think we're realizing we're running out of time. We've been talking, I mean, the climate crisis is not something that showed up, you know, last year. It's like been talked about for decades. I mean, people have been predicting this for a long, long time, and we continue to kind of kick the can down the road. And I think as we get more, you know, more research and more experts saying, okay, you know, emergency, you know, we have to figure this out. Like, people are, you know, this is where the technology is trying to come into play, but I don't think we're going to technology ourselves out of this issue until we start changing our human behavior.
Yeah.
And like, how do we do that? How do we change culture, human behavior? How do we balance resources from places of abundant resources to less resources. I mean, we have such a huge concentration of wealth among a few. Like, yeah, how, I mean, why are we sending people to the moon on, I don't know.
And you have to take a step back. And I think the idea too of climate action is a positive perspective on climate change, right? We got to reframe our positioning on that we can be part of the solution, because it does become overwhelming. It has been a known fact. Some people are kind of just awoken to the idea that, wow, we do have a problem. Some still have yet to do that.
Yeah.
But they too will age out. And I think this idea of, you know, it's immersive in society. It becomes a different lifestyle choice in the way you kind of go at things. But you know, speaking of water, Jennifer, it's interesting. I had an interesting business idea, and maybe you want to be in on this. We can move up to Greenland. We'll start a bottled water company. We'll just take the big ice chunks and we'll melt it down, put it in bottled water plastic and ship it around the world. I think that'll make sense. And then we can sponsor COP27 like Coca-Cola is doing, that leads to the other problem, right? Is good intentions of people want to partake in this, but there's vested interest that folks that already have at a top level, those positions where they don't want to lose that global leadership. Yet, you know, I think from what I've seen, it's like Coca-Cola has produced their rate of increase for plastics going up about 3-4% still every year, despite sponsoring a big climate conference at COP27 in Egypt. So how do we make sense? That's a big question for you, but how do we make sense of that? When, you know, you want to do the good things, but and you're kind of greenwashed a good storyline, but ultimately we all got to get this done together, right?
Yeah, no, and I think, you know, to your point, I mean, we all have to look inward too. Like, what are we willing to give up? I mean, what are we willing to change about our own personal lifestyle? And like, this isn't an issue that's going to be one person global solution. As you know, not one company is going to change their mode of operation. It's going to change everything, but everybody has to figure out, like, and this isn't a popular line, right? Like, what are we going to do differently in order to make a difference? And, you know, that may mean, okay, we're not going to be able to do this anymore. Our business model no longer will work effectively in this new environment, or my personal actions are no longer contributing to a positive outcome. Mm. How do I change my behavior? How do I change my business model? How do I change my government policies or my local policy, like whatever, local ordinances to align with what the future needs? And then that's part where, great, that can be like top-down action, but like it needs to be a little bit of both. Like, we also, I think, need to have visionary leaders that show what a future possibility looks like and how people can fit into it and get on that bandwagon, you know, that culture shift. And I think sometimes the whole narrative ends up being too overwhelming for people, too doom and gloom. Like, they just don't think that their individual actions are going to make a difference. So people just shut down and just keep doing business as usual. So, you know, what are the beacons of hope, or, you know, the light that we want to see and shine on people to be like, oh, this is what you can be doing. This is making a difference. Here's the impact that this is having. This is why it's important that it might be a difficult thing to change or do, but it matters. You know,
I think
it was great. I mean, when we saw the numbers during the pandemic of like, okay, all of a sudden all this business travel isn't happening. Like, didn't we reduce CO2 emissions globally? Like, and look at all these great new technologies we have. Like, I don't have to drive somewhere to go to your studio. We can be having this conversation in the virtual world. And
right in my kitchen.
Right in your kitchen.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I'm concerned about that red cup. I think you might have taken that. So
there might be some mice in there.
I know. But no doubt about it. And I think, you know, we look at our political leaders now as who's going to be the individual that steps up to be someone that runs on climate, or that is the primary element of their campaign, is around climate, food systems. And I think it's happening in other parts of the world. Maybe we're getting there stateside. This administration is taking actions. They held a big conference at the White House. There's definitely interest in partaking, changing food systems and being a major part of the climate issue. And Tufts, who you're affiliated with, you went to school there, and obviously now New Entry is a affiliation with Tufts, was a major part of that. So are there lessons to be taken out of what this administration is doing, or is it just a initial cornerstone that we build from?
No, No, I mean, we haven't had a White House conference on hunger and nutrition in over 50 years. So this was a huge step forward. And, you know, the first one was organized by someone from the Tufts Friedman School. And then this one was also a big push. We were highly involved in that. And the goal was really to bring attention to these issues and to map out a course of strategy and then to take these listening sessions, take this conference, take this brain trust. And then, yes, let's do something actionable with it. Let's look at the policies that can be created. Let's look at the next 2023 Farm Bill that's coming up next year. Let's like really change the needle. I mean, some of the programs that came out of the last conference were revolutionary in terms of how they've supported, you know, access to healthy food and, you know, nutrition benefits and other things. And I think this is it's probably long overdue, but like, you know, there's no time like the present to, you know, to revamp that. And again, looking at the problems of the day, like let's come out of that with an agenda that we can, you know, develop some actionable strategies and get new legislation passed, get new programs developed and put things into place. And if that can, you know, if that is happening, I know there's work being done on that right now. I think that's a good step in the right direction. I think that's what people need to see coming out of these convenings is, yeah, we need to see what happens on the ground and what resources are happening. And I think the Biden administration is definitely putting money at, you know, where their values are and things that he's talked about and caring about. From our perspective as a farmer training program, like seeing all the new programs that have come out of USDA, you know, out of nowhere, basically, like, here's technical assistance money to help producers get access to USDA programs and resources. Here's this new innovative program to help think about how we're going to access land, capital, and markets for farmers that have been traditionally underserved. You know, here's a climate smart commodity grant at the tune of $70 million. Like, let's put money into this and figure out how we're going to do more of it. Like, I feel like every other week there's a new program coming out. Now there's the local food purchasing assistance program. Like, here's money that are given to the states to then help state governments buy local food from underserved and smaller farmers and regional producers. There's infrastructure money being invested. Like, the whole infrastructure grant, like all of these things are infrastructure bill. There's a lot of resources that I think are really trying to get to, you know, to develop more innovation, to make sure that historically underserved populations are getting access to these federal resources, that, you know, on the ground work is being supported to rebuild the kind of food system that we need and to address, you know, our pending climate crisis. So, I don't know. That's, to me, that's real action and, you know, real resources being, I mean, people argue, is it enough, but it's something. It's step one. And I think those that will, you know, continue to snowball if we can continue to keep investing in those kind of programs.
I have had the opportunity of listening to you so many times in these conversations. You co-hosted, you know, over about a dozen of these conversations with me, and I always pay attention because I always learn something new in this. And I remember one of the things you said to Mary Nessel when we had that conversation with her, was regarding policy, that you wish you had in school had focused more on, because it's such an impact on food production. I've seen, at least maybe, and I don't know what your point of view is, but it seems that there's volumes of younger folks, 20-something-year-old, 30-year-olds, and even younger, that are interested in this policy. And schools have adapted so that you can now get degrees and focus on policy. So that is going to percolate its way up to having drastic change. That this is a, you know, this is a passion. This is a belief in everyone that's doing these things. So they now are skilled. They have the toolkit to go forward and deliver. So maybe it's a generation away. Maybe we do, you know, these acts will have huge positive impact when that ripple effect gets felt at a, at the highest level of policymaking.
Yeah. You know, I think even in my son's school, he's in fourth grade. I mean, they just developed a whole new portrait of a learner, and civic engagement is a huge value in that portrait of a learner. I mean, how do we want our kids to learn moving forward? And if they're not taught to be civically engaged or see us as parents, you know, going to the voting booth and getting involved in, you know, community town politics, community committees, like showing up for, you know, support marches or protests or whatever it is, like it's all part of the system, right? Like if we're not showing our kids, like you have to be, democracy is only works if you are a part of it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to uphold those values yourself and be involved. Like you can't just be a couch surfer and then sit and complain that the world doesn't work the way you like it. Like, what are you doing about it?
I know. You know, you're right. And it's easy and it's challenging. It's a bit almost like the realm of social media, but I too fell victim to political theater in the last election, just sitting on the couch watching CNN and getting so infuriated about things. And then, you know, trying to explain to your kids, like, It's okay. Don't do what dad's doing right now. Just, you know, we want to move forward with this, but had to stop. No. I had to stop paying attention to that, or at least working on things that we could control, or working on things that you could actually have action upon, and not letting the big things that are out of your control hinder or prevent you from, you know, really taking steps forward or being part of that change.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, there are so many ways we can all be involved in whatever way works best for us, whether it's making a donation to a campaign or postcard yeah. campaign or showing up to a town hall or whatever the case may be, but paying attention, sign on letters. I mean, yeah. there's a lot of, you know, passively active things that we can do, you know, depending on if you're staying informed and educated on the topics.
Right.
Yeah. And then there are people who are paid to do that work well, obviously. And if we're not behind the message that we want, there's certainly money behind someone else's message. So yeah, there needs to be a balance.
Yeah. All right. Final question here. It's got 18 parts. No, I'm just kidding. It's like,
as always, you're a good question.
I know that's back to school, Ronnie Dangerfield. Anyway, no, the two parts. That's it. What is your biggest concern right now with production, with local food systems moving forward? I think you can guess the second part of that question afterwards, but what is your biggest concern with this right now?
My biggest concern is that in a capitalist society, if farmers are not economically viable, then we don't have stewards who have the knowledge and capacity, skill, or desire to grow and produce and distribute our food.
Yeah.
So, you know, because we live in this society, that means you have to make money, you have to be able to pay your mortgage, put food on your own table, put your kids through school, whatever it is that you need to do with your family livelihood. Mm. If farmers can't make a living farming, then we're not going to get people into the industry. When people exit, they're going to sell their land to continued industrial consolidation or to development.
Right.
And who is going to grow our food? We're not developing, you know, artificial intelligence and robots. You know, that is never going to take the place of management.
Yeah.
And I think that that's my biggest worry, is that it's really hard to convince people to go into this sector if what it means is they're going to sacrifice and work 80 to 100 hours a week and still not be able to pay their bills or yeah. see a future in it and give up after 7 to 10 years. I mean, that's yeah. unfortunately the reality of my world. Is we are a beginning farmer training program. We can get people excited, they're passionate, they see a vision, they want to grow food, they want to steward the land, they want to feed their community, they want to contribute to society. They're important players in the food system, but they burn out because they're not making enough money to live.
Hmm.
And that to me is really scary. What are we doing to change that? What needs to happen? Do we need to do what? Like, it's not just, oh, people need to pay more. Well, not everybody can pay more.
Right.
Like we talked about that at the beginning, but farmers somehow need to be paid for producing a valuable product and doing all the things that they do, stewarding the land, you know, building community, providing jobs, all these things. So I don't know. To me, that's my biggest worry, is that we can't figure out the economic viability piece. And it's not to say that there are some farmers who are making money, but there are plenty who are not. And like 80% of farmers have off-farm jobs. What other sector do we tell you, like, this is your career, but you have to have another job to be able to do that career? You have to like subsidize your regular full-time job paycheck in order to grow food for the rest of the community. Like, that's not a viable proposition.
Yeah.
So.
All right.
Part two is, what am I doing about it?
No, not at all. Well, I we've been talking for 30 minutes on what you're doing about it. And it's wonderful work. Amazing work. Part two is, what are you most optimistic about? What are you seeing as those glimmers of hope? What they kind of, we're talking about that positive thing in the back of the positive voice in the back of your head that can get you to look at it as glass half full or empty. So what are you optimistic about as you speak to your son about this and explain future's looking good? We can do this.
Yeah. I mean, I get hope because there are so many people that want to do this. Mm. I think we underestimate the fact that people look at farming and growing food and being environmental stewards as something they want to do for their communities and they're passionate about. Like, I mean, we have young people coming in our doors all the time full of like, I want to farm. Like, this is great. I love being outside. I love growing food. I love the complexity of it. I love the, you know, ever-changing dynamic of it. You're always problem solving. Like,
right.
Yeah. You know, there's so many components to it, and people feel so proud when they have this beautiful product that they're giving and nourishing other people and nourishing the land and, you know, building community and culture around food. Like, that feels really good. And people want to do that. So like, I'm hopeful that there is a generation that is excited about it, that really deeply cares. I'm excited that young people care and want to change the system, and that we are seeing more engagement and, you know, civic engagement and other things. I'm hopeful that we are having these conversations, that our administration takes it seriously and is investing resources where they can in some good things. I think there's a lot more to do. So I don't know. I think we just have to keep plugging away and hopefully changing hearts and minds and policy and culture.
Yeah.
Like, those things all have to happen.
Yeah. I agree. Human spirit is a good thing to bet on in the future. I think it, there's a certain level of cyclicality to it, but I think, I finger on the pulse and keep positive with it. And everything that we've talked about, even some of the negative things on things, are just because we have to go through that learning process to get to a point where we can actually take those steps forward. So,
what do we have if we don't have hope, right?
I don't know. Yeah. Hey, Jennifer, thank you so much for taking the time. As always, great stuff. So good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Aaron. I appreciate it.
Of course.